This is the Future of Law podcast, where we explore what it means to be a lawyer and law firm of the future. I'm Judas from Australia.
And I'm Tessa from Canada. We are two entrepreneurs working on each edge of the planet, bringing you a platform to explore what the future holds for the legal industry.
Hi, Margaret. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Not a problem. Thank you for accepting to be part of it. I think we have some interesting things to cover today. Would you be able to, first of all, tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I am originally from the Caribbean, called to practice at the Bar of Trinidad and Tobago in 1995. Specialized in public procurement law, and basically turned entrepreneur. Have been building businesses first in public procurement law as a consultancy and training and capacity building organization in the Caribbean, and speaking and training in that particular area of the world. I now live in the UK. I am pursuing my doctorate in policy research and practice, and I incubate businesses that are trying to create change against the Agenda 2030 and just do lots of exciting stuff. It's difficult to put one hat on me to say, this is what I do. I usually, start with the public procurement law because that is my specialization and my professional background. But really and truly, I am very passionate about integral ways of doing and being. And so I do a lot of reading and research on emotions and decision-making and behavior change. And those areas are areas that I'm really passionate about and how we can understand more about how we make decisions so that we could make better decisions in respect of groups.
Fantastic.
Nation states and corporations and that kind
amazing.
Of
amazing. Well, that's exactly, I think it's, you've put it really well. The fact that, you don't really feel clear with one hat. You have many, many hats, and that's exactly the sort of person that we like to have on and explore things with. Oftentimes the avant-garde and the things we find are in the gaps, right? It's in the non-traditional pathways.
Yeah, definitely.
So speaking of those non-traditional pathways, I haven't heard a lot about public procurement policy. Could you tell me a bit more about what that is?
All right. That is good that you asked that, because I remember when I started developing capacity building programs in this area in the Caribbean in 2000. We incorporated the Caribbean Procurement Institute in 2006 and spent the next year and a half just working with experts from all over the world and developing our first program in January 2008. I remember when I first did that, and we had over 240 people come into this, and several of them were senior lawyers. Many of them asked, a very similar question. They said, but what is public procurement law? Is this a thing? And this was in 2008. And let me tell you, really, as simply as I can, what it is. It is the law that governs the way governments buy. And if we think about how governments meet development needs in a community, if we think about how governments create any change in respect of any policy, implement any policy that they have, they are going to at some point have to spend money, whether it is on consulting services, whether it's on works, whether it's on goods, any policy a government has, whether it's a taxation, any policy, in order to implement that policy, the government has to spend money so that at the end of the day, the law that governs how governments spend money is what is typically within the context of public procurement law. There are areas, there are attempts to streamline public procurement law only in terms of goods, works, and services. But I think that the philosophy underpinning the transparency, the fairness, the accountability, and the kinds of checks and balances we need to put in for buying goods, works, and services applies across the board when government is spending any sort of money.
And we talk about the government because they're the biggest spenders. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're the largest spenders. Well, we know they're competitors now with some of the, you know, big five, six multinational corporations that exist. But governments, by and large, across the globe are the largest procurers. So in the EU alone, it accounts for 19% of the GDP. And in developing countries, it's far more than 19% of GDP, because there's a lot of expenditure in developing countries on capital infrastructure projects and that sort of thing. So in some countries, it has been estimated to be as much as 70%. And so, yeah, but I mean, in the Caribbean, let's say it's estimated to be 30-40% on average among Caribbean countries. So, I mean, there really is a span depending on, one, how you define public procurement, what are the statistics that you're capturing there, and and the level of development in a country.
And I think this obviously, you know, besides the fact that itself is a policy and there's a legal framework, which is, you know, speaks to the relevance of why we're talking here. I think the other reason that we explored previously in our earlier calls about its relevance was because of the power that it lends to individuals eventually, right? Within the same sort of framework. They are the biggest buyers. They can be the biggest buyers. But at the end of the day, everyone procures things, and it speaks to how we would build a framework around doing it so that it's more circular.
Okay. Hey, you've gone to circular. That's exciting. Yes. But let's make it simple and put it this way. I think if you just look at your own life as a human being, you cannot eat, you cannot clothe yourself, you cannot educate yourself, you cannot progress, get medical supplies, you cannot take care of yourself in any way in modern society without buying. And if you don't buy effectively within your means and making best use of the money that you have, you will see how that's going to impact your development. So on a very, very simple level as a human being, if you take all your money and spend it on all of it and spend it on a party or a car or anything like that, you will see the consequences of that later on in your life. If you chose to do that instead of spending money on education or healthcare or on your security and safety, you see? And so the same way that applies as a human being in modern society, it applies to every corporation on the planet. A corporation cannot sell its first good, work or service without first procuring the inputs and buying the inputs and putting it in that way. And similarly for a nation state, a government cannot achieve its first development goal without first procuring. And that's why, you know, that's why I'm so passionate about this area, because I think it's almost one of those areas that are invisible to us, because we're just doing it unthinkingly. We are buying unthinkingly. That's why there's a whole movement right now for more conscious buying, right, on the part of individuals. And I would think that public procurement law is developing in understanding itself as not only regulating the way governments buy to ensure effectiveness and value for money, which are the traditional drivers of public procurement policy, but now we are seeing a huge shift toward how can we harness the purchasing power of governments and public sector bodies to pursue social and environmental goals. And now, an even later shift, and I would say we are really very, very, it's a very emergent area of circular procurement. How do we leverage government expenditure in such a way that we are not part of the take, make, and dispose economy, which is damaging the environment and causing immense suffering, as we all know? Don't want to jump on just being, you know, it's not a polemic I'm going here for, but we want to see, with circular procurement and circular economy policy, how can we leverage all this money that government is spending not to continue accelerating the linear economy and all its negative impacts? And how do we use that and harness that into a more circular, reduce, reuse, recycle way of thinking about products and works that we are
spending? It's interesting, the overlap there, because, you know, in other industries, we have this emergence of circular economy. And even in the law, that's something that, you know, I've discussed before as well, about it becoming more circular, where your linear sort of capital expenditure in an office and all of these things start to actually become a technology stack, which is a subscription base. So it no longer, you know, is a capital expenditure, more operational expenditure, and there's a lot more leverage. But the funny overlap, the interesting overlap, is they're both related, both those concepts are related to law, but they both point to one sort of obvious point for me, which is I'd put to you, which is because of that phenomena, the jurisdiction starts to become, well, it necessitates a global jurisdiction. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And absolutely, because we have globalized our economy. There is no question. We have a global economy. We have a world where capital and corporations can freely roam, right, and establish and make money and can divide up their operations. You're outsourcing labor here, you're selling here, you're creating revenue somewhere else. We have globalized our economy, and we now need to start rethinking our many times jurisdictionally bound systems. That corporations right now are able to exploit the gaps, because there will be gaps. Because if we've been thinking about our systems from the perspective of a nation state, and yet because of the developments in technology and all of that, we've been able to operate outside of the nation state, which is the world that we're living in right now. You know, the nation state laws are now trying to play catch up with the globalized economy that we are all living in. And instead of trying to play catch up, I think what we need to start thinking about is, you know, because we're trying to play catch up thinking in the same way that we thought before, within these borders and boundaries. And I really think there needs to be a fundamental rethinking of law in society, much more than how do we play catch up and how do our laws capture the corporations doing that within our and so that's why I think you and I connected so deeply, Kudus, because both you and I are thinking about the future of law and how we need to address legal change at a systemic level. And legal change, quite frankly, is always at a systemic level. And one of the things, you know, I was sharing with you before, and I think is important to mention here, because yes, it is a globalized issue, because at the end of the day, when we look at the outputs that are being created in our world today, we can't address these outputs. We can't address the consequences just on the basis of what we are seeing and the trends. We always have to look, you know, if we approach this from a systems thinking lens, we always have to look at what are the systems that are allowing for and facilitating and enabling the world that we are living in. And therefore, what are the attractors of these systems that are holding this system in place? And how can we address those attractors if we are not getting the outputs, the outcomes in society that we want? And my point has always been, we cannot address those systems and rethink those systems unless we rethink the law, because those systems are 9 times out of 10 enshrined in law or facilitated by the law, because that's what it is. The law is the agreement that we, the set of agreements that we have come to in society to govern the way we interact. And so if we're not happy with the output of our interactions, we have to start thinking about how does the law facilitate this and how can we rethink
that. So essentially what you're saying is that instead of thinking, it's taking a step back from problem solving at a micro level, which is, you know, how do we patch this law? Mm. How do we, right?
Or a tactical
level. And starting to look at it from a macro level, which is actually taking a step back and assessing the entire system itself and saying, how would we, knowing where we're heading is almost unknown territory. It is almost, it's novel. You know, does the system that we have in place at the moment even sufficiently serve it? And I think it's safe to say it's failing to. It's managing to hold itself together. But the question actually is, the more pressing question would be to take a step back and look at the system as a whole and think, how is this set up for the next 100 years, for the next 200 years, you know, and beyond? Yeah. You know, like, what is the basis, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, Kudus. And, you know, there's a phrase that I'm coining right now and using right now in the context of teaching and mentoring other lawyers. And I call it meta-legal cognition, mm-hmm. meta-legal thinking, which is us stepping back and starting to think about the way we are thinking about the law, and also think about the thinking behind the law. What is the philosophy of the laws that we are, you know, implementing, that we are practitioners of? You know, I think for too long, you know, our legal system, and I mean, I don't want to speak in too sure. much of a generality, but I just want to say that I've observed that a lot of times we qualify as lawyers, and I was a part of this, and we've learned the law, and we come out and we become, you know, exceptional practitioners yes. of the law without really thinking about, well, what's the philosophy behind this law that we are, you know, we know it really well, we know the gaps, we know the opportunities, and we can advise our clients. But what's the philosophy behind it? And that was something that happened to me in public procurement law, because in public procurement law, when I first came into it, I came into it, you know, passionate about mm-hmm. anti-corruption and holding yes. governments accountable for government expenditure. And so I would say in the very early stages, that was around 2003, 2004, 2002, 2003, 2004, up to 2006. I mean, I was just, I was learning a lot about public procurement law, becoming specialized in that area. But to a certain extent, I was basically parroting or promoting that which was taught as good public right. procurement law at the UN level, at right. the EU level. In the early 1990s, there was a revolution of sorts in public procurement where the EU was coming together and coming up with its own directives, and the EU decided they needed to manage access to opportunities for suppliers throughout mm-hmm. the region, and to, you know, foster competition and all of that, and to get against, you know, come against this protectionism within EU member states, because remember they were just the establishing union. Themselves and all of that. And so they, and so in 1994 they came up with the public procurement directives, the EU public procurement directives, and that was all about stimulating competition. And so it was about openness and transparency within yes. the EU. Yeah, so the EU public procurement directives just became this Uber thing, you know, to stimulate this Uber paradigm shift globally, to stimulate the competition within EU member states. And in that same time, the early 1990s, you saw the UN model law passed in respect of public procurement. You saw the World Trade Organization government procurement agreement established. All of this happened in 1994 in public right. procurement law at the same time. And what you saw, that there was a lot of similarities between these conditions and obligations and the philosophy behind public procurement law. And what happened is that, so I became very, you know, au courant with UN model law and public procurement, the WTO government procurement agreement, World Bank, IMF, all their policies in respect of public procurement law. And most of them were, you know, fairly coterminous in terms of their objectives, which was to stimulate trade and development in that. We stimulate trade, increase competition, improve competition, and achieve value for money. And so, as I was saying, you know, when I first started out, I just became a good practitioner of public procurement law, thinking that the objective was to hold government accountable, but not really understanding the underlying economic premises of public procurement law. And it was only when I got deeper into it that I started to see that, wait a minute, this open competitive competition, which is amazing and great within a particular sphere, if you want to build the economies within a particular sphere or a region, that's great, building capacity in that regard. But when you start thinking about it globally, where there is an uneven marketplace and where suppliers in one nation state are trying to compete with other suppliers in other nation states, you will see that this open competitive procurement didn't work and doesn't work for developing countries. And in fact, even within the EU itself, the EU has these kinds of rules within itself. But when it deals with third states outside of the EU, those rules are not the same. There are barriers to third states competing and participating in the EU economy. But what happened when the UN and the World Trade Organization, these organizations started to promote this outside of the EU and started to promote this globally, you saw a lot of what we then called, and I know we shouldn't be calling it developing countries anymore, but let's say lesser industrial states. We saw these lesser industrial states who were putting these laws in place were then opening up their economy to players and suppliers from much more industrialized states that obviously came with all of the economies of scale. And so in all of these less industrial states, you saw these big companies, foreign companies coming in, getting most of the public procurement, government works contracts and concessions and all of that. And you saw no capacity being built. You saw very fledgling local capacity and so being built. And so it had an impact within countries. And so, I started to understand that, wait a minute, in order for me to really be effective in trying to build public procurement capacity in the Caribbean, I needed to really start thinking more about the economics and industrialization policy and all of that. And that made me have to now go and start learning about all those other areas and starting to really unpack the philosophical underpinning of public procurement law. And I say this is meta-legal thinking. This is coming outside of the law and looking to see, well, what are the interconnections between law and other fields? And then what is the systemic output or analysis from a systemic analysis of the law? What is the law producing? And so you're looking at other fields, you're taking a step back, you're looking at the interconnections, and then you are developing a theory of law in your particular area. That is meta-legal thinking to me, one aspect of meta-legal thinking. And so, yeah, I think it's really critical right now when a shift is taking place on the planet where we're starting to recognize that the way our economy operates does not really serve let's see how I can put it. It doesn't serve the sustenance of life on this planet. And I'm not saying this in a moral way. I'm saying this from a scientific standpoint, from the research. If we continue operating the economy in which we are doing, the take, make, and dispose economy, we are threatening life on this planet. And so now that we understand that, we now need, as lawyers, I believe, who are operating in every field of the law, it's not just economic laws that we need to look at. We need to look at every aspect of the law and see what is the philosophical underpinning of this law. How does this interrelate with other fields of study that are linked to what is happening in society, on the ground and on the planet? And how do we develop new theories of law in our particular areas?
And this is something that I think is fascinating, which is why I was really excited to have you on the podcast, because you've gone through this journey, and this is, we're in 2019 now. So, you know, you're talking about over 10, 15 years ago, coming to this realization, and but not only coming to the realization, actually starting to sort of deploy metalegal cognition or metalegal thinking, and then apply it in building and becoming essentially a leader in public procurement policy or public procurement law. And I think the reason it excites me so much is because of my very strong belief and philosophy that the amount of micro changes that are occurring in the disruption of the legal industry is such that, and the vision of where it all could potentially go is so fundamentally different from where it has been and where it is now, that this is almost a requirement for those who wish to thrive and succeed in the coming disruption and the coming wave and the coming tsunami, where everything is going to shift. We have to deploy, we have to address it from its core, and by its core is meant what is the framework that we actually operate within. And a lot of these, if not all of them, are up for debate, discussion, and innovation, really. You know, it's up for us to develop a new way. It's up to us to develop, to see the connections actually as well, you know, how it connects to other things, the same way that you just mentioned, that, you know, not just your area of law, but other areas of law, and then outside of the law. And I think that's one thing. Yeah. And that's one thing that we didn't sort of really highlight, but I would do that. And I think it's important for our listeners is that, you know, you drew the relevance between your area of law, the public procurement, and the economy. But you also drew a line between how fundamental law is to society in general. So this isn't, so I say this because I want to highlight the fact that this isn't something that's specific to your niche. I think it applies across all aspects of law, because if you look deep enough, you understand that law fundamentally, obviously, is integrated to society where we work. But specific areas of law are all going to be part and parcel of that framework of law that society lives in. And that, you know, and obviously with the expansion of jurisdiction that we covered earlier on in the episode, you know, it now becomes a global conversation. It does become a Wild West. And I think for me and where I'm at in my journey, certainly from where you're at, it's an exciting time. From where I'm at, I'm just overwhelmed with energy and like excitement about, you know, tackling that problem. I think that it's something that also needs to become very much part of the discussion at university, or if university is unable to facilitate that through their legal education, that it needs to happen as early as a law student to really start to think about, you know, understand what it is now, understand what it may become, and let them be created before perhaps they jump into the current state of play. And because that's what's generating that current state of play is, you know, at least from my perspective, very toxic. There's systemic problems in there. So it lends a lot of problems to graduates that move in, and a lot of them find themselves disillusioned or disheartened after a few short years of working in that capacity. So I think it is a very opportune time, but it's very important for us to be able to facilitate this with young and old, but I guess my particular focus is with graduates and law students who before they step into what it is happening right now, can perhaps have a wider purview of where things might be going and start to build towards that, because they can essentially create their own futures, you know, create the constructs with which they're going to practice in, or they're going to operate in.
Yeah, I would say we are in such an exciting time. And I think that there is, you know, there's a real unique opportunity here for lawyers in particular, in my view, because I think all across industry, across countries, across the globe, we are recognizing that there needs to be a system change. And if we need to have a system change, we need the people who are trained, current set of systems, to really start applying their creative energies to how we can facilitate the rethinking of current systems, which would be the laws, the policies, and the practices. It's a really, really exciting time. And I think your point is so important that we now need to build capacity among lawyers, yes, for this shift, to become leaders in this shift, to become the engineers of this shift. And I agree, it should be in universities, it should be at law schools and at that level. But I would tell you that if we, you and I, Kudus, and others who are thinking like this and recognizing that there needs to be this shift, wait for the university to do it, you know, it's going to take quite a few decades again for it to get to where it needs to get to. And so I look back again at my work with public procurement when I became passionate about, started to understand deeply the philosophy behind, you know, government buying and the economics of, you know, as a Caribbean region, we need to start thinking about this differently from just the general global narrative on public procurement best practice. We need to have our own theories about how to do it. And I mean, there were two ways I could have gone. I could have gone knocking on the universities in the region and say, come on, we need to do this. And then I would have been at
mercy.
I would have been waiting for them. Yeah, at the mercy, at the behest, when they would be ready and the bureaucracy and all of that. And I said, you know what? No, I'm going to link with all of these experts from all over the world, bring them in, have them help me develop the curricula and all of that, develop an institute and build the capacity. And that's what I did from 2006 to recently to now. The Caribbean Procurement Institute was acquired by the Procurement Innovation and Leadership Lab, which is an organization that I am involved in here in the UK. And what just happened this year, it started at the last year, but we're rolling it out this year. What just happened is that the University of the West Indies just developed its first master's program in procurement with a specialization in procurement law. And I have been invited in to drive the curricula there and design it and to teach parts of it. And that it would now be starting.
Yeah, you understand that's what fantastic.
Kudos. And so for us, right, and so that's how, that's 2006 to now, you could calculate how long it took for, you know,
University
of the West Indies to get here.
Yeah.
But the point I'm trying to make about what we're trying to do is that, you know, I'm really excited about the work that we are doing together in the Future Law Institute and the Future Lab Legal, working together to develop the kinds of curricula that needs to happen. And hopefully the universities are going to, you know, come on board and recognize at some point that this is part of the mainstream curricula as opposed to, you know, waiting and relying on the innovation coming
from the outside. Of course. Well, I mean, what you've identified is, perhaps without saying, is that you said we need to build the capacity. You did say that, right? We need to build the capacity. But part of it is also creating space for people with that alignment, with that passion, with that drive, with those visions, have a place for them to come and actually work these things out. You know, your particular journey has been one where you've had to figure that all out by yourself. But as this becomes a more, I guess, mainstream, popular conversation, and more people want to get involved in it, and more people feel that they are of this vision and alignment, it needs to scale. So there needs to be a space, there needs to be a network, there needs to be companies such as mine, hopefully, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. And institutes that you've briefly mentioned that allow people to actually engage in that, in solving those problems while still, you know, being fully engaged in the actual industry itself. We don't want to obviously separate and say, well, you know, these institutes are in a bubble and they don't really relate to what's happening right now. It's a combination of being able to see what's practical and pragmatic now, but also make no sort of bones about the fact that the direction we're heading in, though, and the and the freedom that's given and the creativity that's required is now something that's quite up until now being sort of shunned or called a distraction. And now it is very much the focal point, and hopefully the spaces that are popping up and arising allow for people to really embrace that fully.
Yeah, and start thinking about this. And that's why I think your podcast is such an important, you know, platform. And I hope more people get to know about the Future of Law podcast and what you're doing here, creating and stimulating.
That's very flattering. Thank you so, much, Margaret. Look, I think it's been a good chat. We will definitely probably have another episode later on in the year. And there may be some more to talk about, some announcements perhaps. But thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been great. Is it okay if I
100% go for things it?
All right. So coming up in June 2019, on the 15th of June 2019, we are having the first ever Circular Procurement Law Policy and Practice Certificate Program put on by the Procurement Innovation and Leadership Lab in partnership with the Future Law Institute in the UK of Bath, and it's geared toward lawyers and procurement professionals and any professionals who want to really understand what are the laws that can enable the circular economy and circular procurement, and what are the blocks and the barriers as well. And it's a really exciting time because we are also creating a whole new community of circular thinking legal professionals. So if anyone is interested in that area, you can, I should give the link, shouldn't I? www.procurementinnovation.org. If you go there under programs, you should see it coming up.
What we'll do is we'll include it in the description as well, in case it didn't come through.
Okay, great. Right. And also, okay. Well, if we could include things in the description,
fantastic.
That's all good.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Speak soon. Talk soon, yeah?
Thank you for joining us. If this episode resonates with you, we'd love for you to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your colleagues and friends. Follow and leave your feedback on Twitter and like us on Facebook.
You can connect with Tessa and myself on LinkedIn, Twitter, and you can also visit our websites, futurelab.legal and legalcreatives.com.